Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael, and we are reading from True West Magazine, the magazine of the history of the American frontier, October 2023 edition. Our first article, The Town Too Tough to Die, by True West Editors. For seven decades, True West has chronicled the legendary history of Tombstone and its notorious citizenry. As it is the 30th anniversary of the Western movie Tombstone, we decided to look back on how the editors of the magazine since 1953 have covered the story of the town of Tombstone and the men and women who contributed to its legendary infamy. And boy, were we surprised by what we discovered in the archives. First, some firsts. Johnny Ringo was the first of Tombstone's lawmen, or outlaws, to be featured in the magazine, Fall 1953, the second issue. Tombstone finally got a headline on the cover of the magazine in April 1955. Wyatt Earp's first mention on a cover, October 1957. Doc Holliday's first cover, February 1960. Wyatt Earp's first cover, August 1993. That's right, Wyatt Earp's visage did not appear on the cover of True West in its first 39 years of publication. On top of that, Tombstone and its infamous citizens only warranted two cover blubs in the 1950s and four in the 1960s, three in the 70s and four in the 80s. But with a hoopla surrounding the release of the movies Tombstone and Wyatt Earp, 1994, True West's then-editor, John Jorski, went all in on Earp and The Town Too Tough to Die for 14 issues from August 1993 to September 1994. Jorski published a Gen Z Boyer feature on Tombstone and Wyatt Earp. For the rest of the 1990s, Tombstone is a cover blurb in five times. Earp makes the cover twice and Doc Holliday once. The February 1999 cover of Wyatt Earp was a Bob Bozbell original, just a few months before he purchased the magazine with Bob McCubbin and moved its headquarters to Cave Creek, Arizona. And as they say, the rest is history. You might describe the past 23 years as True West's golden era of Wyatt Earp, Doc Holliday, and Tombstone. With the movie on the current issue, it will be the second time for the walk down from the film and the 27th time that Arizona's legendary town and its icons have been featured on the cover. And guaranteed, it won't be the last, for Tombstone is truly the town too tough to die. True West Magazine, October 2023 edition. On the Trail of Charlie Russell, by Candy Moulton. Travel across Montana and discover the state through the life and art of the cowboy artist. Charles M. Russell was 16 when he first arrived in the Judas Basin of Montana in 1880 and found work on a sheep ranch. He visited family in Missouri and Illinois in the winter of 1882 and returned in the spring to work as a cowhand on the O.H. Ranch in the Judith Basin area. The region remains sparsely populated but is rich in history and retains its natural beauty from the days Russell first arrived here. The county of Judith Basin encompasses nearly 300,000 acres surrounded by four mountain ranges, including the Judith, Snowy, High Woods, and Little Belt Mountains, and is the location of the Lewis and Clark National Forest. To the north and west are Fort Benton, the Missouri River, and Great Falls. Russell lived with Jack Hoover in a cabin in the Little Belt Mountains above the town of Utica, when he engaged in some of his early cowboy work in the state of Montana. The Utica Museum includes artifacts and photos from the homestead era and the period when Russell was a local resident. The winter of 1886-87 was particularly brutal, a season later known as the Big Die-Up, when tens of thousands of head of cattle succumbed to harsh winter weather in Montana, across the Dakotas and Wyoming. When the owner of the O.H. Ranch asked his foreman for a report on how the cattle herd were doing, the response was a small watercolor drawing Charlie Russell did that featured a gaunt steer, in which he entitled, Waiting for a Chinook. This drawing is one of the most recognized of all C.M. Russell art pieces and gave the artist his first exposure to an audience beyond his own family and the cowboys he rode with. The drawing, eventually displayed in a store window in Helena, garnered Russell several commissions for new art. Even so, he continued his cowboy work for more than a decade and later spent time with members of the Blackfeet Nation. This acquaintance with Indians and cowboys would serve him well as an artist. Russell's career might have been much different had he not met and married Nancy Cooper in Cascade. The house where they lived, called the Honeymoon Cottage, has been restored by a local resident and now can be visited with some advanced planning. Before their marriage, the structure was just 12 feet by 24 feet, but Russell added a kitchen, which made it 10 feet longer and no doubt pleased his young wife. The Russells later settled near Great Falls, and he began making his living full-time as an artist. Much of his success was due to his natural-born talent, but his recognition was definitely enhanced by Nancy's marketing abilities. She promoted his work in Montana and to the world, eventually engaging him in shows from London and New York to California. To follow the life of Charlie Russell, start at the C.M. Russell Museum in Great Falls, which has over 2,000 items in the collection, including artifacts and original art, and his home and art studio. Walking into the studio, it's possible to imagine at his easel, telling stories of the old days as he creates the visual experience that he lived. In March, the museum opened a new exhibition on loan from the Montana Historical Society. The exhibit demonstrates the friendship between Russell and Malcolm McKay, who saw his first Russell painting in 1911 in New York. Among the pieces McKay acquired, and that are now on display at the museum, are Charles M. Russell and His Friends, 1922, and The Roundup, 1913. Other Russell originals are displayed at the Montana State Capitol in Helena. The country Russell lived in and painted includes a large part of the north-central Montana area, from Helena to Great Falls and Lewiston, and then north to the Canadian border. Some of Russell's collectors believed he was painting a landscape and a lifestyle that was ending. But a visit to the area makes it clear where Charlie got his inspiration and that the culture is still evident. First People's Buffalo Jump State Park, a national historic landmark near Ulm, about 11 miles southwest of Great Falls, is an archaeological site believed to be the largest bison cliff jump in North America. American Indians harvest bison at this site for at least a couple of centuries before explorers Meriwether Lewis and William Clark traveled through the region in 1805. The mile-long sandstone cliff has buffalo hunting drive lines that lead to the sheer cliff face. Below are compacted remains of the animals driven over the cliff. An interpreted center explains how the site was used. To the northeast of Great Falls, visit Fort Benton, one of Montana's early state capitals and an important trade community on the Missouri River. The Missouri Breaks Interpretive Center focuses on the natural and cultural history of the Upper Missouri River Breaks National Monument and Upper Missouri River. Historic Fort Benton has collectors depicting the fur trade era, including the trade with nations of the Blackfoot Confederacy and with men who took their charge, Red River carts, along the Whoop-Up Trail to Canada. The fort's reconstructed bourgeois house includes the fort manager's quarters and the clerk's office. The Star Gallery of Western Art, located in the ceremonial room, has rare Bob Scriver bronzes and Carl Bodmer lithographs. The Museum of the Northern Great Plains, also in Fort Benton, has on display the Hornaday Smithsonian bison and an impressive collection of Western art by 19th century artists, including John McStanley and Granville Stewart. Because Russell spent time living with Indians of the region, travel west to visit the Blackfeet Heritage Center and Art Gallery in Browning, which has a diverse collection of artwork, including paintings, jewelry, and drums by Blackfeet and other tribal artisans. One piece of art Russell created after his time with the Blackfeet was When the Land Belonged to God, painted in 1914. Montana is justly proud of Charlie Russell, and there are displays of his art at various locations in Helena, including the state capitol. A wide spot in the road. The cowboy artist. C.M. Russell made oil and watercolor paintings and did drawings on stationery, napkins, and random pieces of paper. In addition, he developed sculptures in wax, clay, plaster, and other materials, some of which were ultimately cast in bronze. The Whitney Gallery of Western Art in Cody holds more than 300 pieces of art by Russell, including paintings, drawings, and sculptures. The mural Russell painted in 1912, Lewis and Clark Meeting Indians at Ross Hole, hangs in the House of Chambers of the Montana Capitol Building in Helena. Among the locations where original Russell art is on display are at the Amon Carter Museum of Western Art in Fort Worth, the Sid Richardson Museum in Fort Worth, which has a new exhibit in 2023, Charles M. Russell, Storyteller Across Media, the Brenton Museum in Bighorn, Wyoming, and the Edeljorg Museum in Indianapolis. With over 4,000 art pieces, you can imagine there are many other museums across the country with Russell originals on display. True West Magazine, November 2023 edition. Hayes in an uproar. Wild Bill Hickok versus the 7th Cavalry. Hickok almost gets an earful. July 17, 1870. Deputy U.S. Marshal James Butler, Wild Bill Hickok, converses with the bartender at Patty Welch's in Hays City, Kansas. Without warning, two 7th Cavalry troopers attack Hickok from the rear, pinning his arms and wrestling him to the floor. A newspaper later reports that five soldiers attacked Bill. Of the two known troopers, Jeremiah Lonergan, a pugilist and powerful man, pins down Hickok. He does everything in his power to keep the lawman's arms away from his body and his pistols. A second soldier, John Kyle, whips out a Remington pistol from underneath his blouse, put the muzzle in Wild Bill's ear, and snapped it, an eyewitness claims. The pistol misfires. Amid the yelling and in consuming commotion, Hickok and the two soldiers grapple on the floor, each trying to get an advantage. At some point, Hickok is wounded in the leg. The historical record is unclear if he was shot or merely injured in the scuffling. In spite of Lonergan's best efforts, Hickok grabs one pistol from his holster and fires a round, hitting Kyle in the wrist. A second round hits Kyle in the side, and he rolls away in agony. Lonergan desperately fights for his life as he tries to keep Hickok's pistol barrel pointed away from him. Pushing against the much larger man, Hickok fights with all of his might, finally turning his pistol far enough to fire. The resulting shot hits Lonergan in the kneecap. Stunned, Lonergan gives up his grip and joins Kyle on the disabled list. Hickok wastes no time escaping as he scrambles to his feet, makes tracks for the back of the saloon, and jumps through a window, taking the glass and sash with him. When news of the gunfight reaches Fort Hays, a number of troopers seize their guns, head for Hays City, and search all the saloons and dives, but they can't find their man. Aftermath, odds and ends. James Butler, Wild Bill Hickok, returned to his room and grabbed a Winchester rifle and 100 rounds of ammunition. He hid out in the Boot Hill Cemetery west of town, waiting for an attack that never came. In the morning, he boarded a train at Big Creek Station and hightailed it out of the area. John Kyle lived until July 18th when he died from his wounds received as a result of a drunken row and not in the line of duty. The year before, Kyle had received the Medal of Honor for protecting his fellow soldiers in an Indian skirmish. Jeremiah Lonergan recovered from his wound. The day after Christmas, in a drunken rage, he threatened to stab a sergeant. He was sentenced to nearly 3 years in Leavenworth in Kansas. He disappeared after that. As the months turned into years, the legend of the gunfight expanded with each retelling, and the tally of soldiers fighting Hickok grew. James Buell's mammoth 1881 tome, Heroes of the Plains, has Hickok fighting 15 soldiers and being wounded 7 times after killing 3 troopers. On the Western Trail by Johnny D. Boggs. November 2023, True West Magazine. Pack it up, round them up, and drive north for an Old West adventure. Sherman, Texas native S.H. Woods was 16 years old when he was on The Second Boss, The Horse Rustler, on a cattle drive in 1881. Although the drive had started along the Chisholm Trail in the Chickasaw Nation, the herd had moved on to the Western Trail, and Dodge City, Kansas was just 8 or 10 miles ahead when a nightmare storm blew in. Talk about thunder and lightning, Woods recalled in the Trail Drivers of Texas, the old-time Trail Drivers Association's mammoth 1924 collection of reminiscences, compiled and edited by J. Marvin Hunter. There is where you could see phosphorus fox fire on our horses' ears and smell sulfur. We saw the storm approaching, and every man, including the rustler, was out on duty. About 10 o'clock at night, we were greeted with a terribly loud clap of thunder and a flash of lightning which killed one of our lead steers just behind me. That started the ball rolling. Between the rumbling, roaring, and rattling of hoofs, horns, thunder, and lightning, it made an old cowpuncher long for headquarters, or to be in his line camp in some dugout hole on the banks of some little stream. And it didn't end there, Wood said, because just as soon as we could get them quiet, some other herd would run into us and give us a fresh start. Finally, so many herds had run together that it was impossible to tell our cattle from others. When lightning flashed, we could see thousands of cattle and hundreds of men all over the prairie, so we turned everything loose and waited patiently for daybreak. It took about a week for trail crews to separate the herds. Those who were driving to Dodge City hadn't far to go, but Woods and his pards were bound for Wyoming, which meant they had to cross the Arkansas River just above Dodge City and move through northwestern Kansas and into Nebraska, where they followed the North Platte from Ogallala to Forts Lorraine, Laramie, and Fetterman in Wyoming. When they left the Platte, they crossed 60 waterless miles in 4 days. In all, Woods recalled, it took us exactly 3 months and 20 days to drive a herd of southern dogies from the Red River and deliver them at the Wyoming ranch. The gist of this story being, the Western Trail was not for sissies. Maybe that's why you hear a lot more songs sung about the Chisholm and Goodnight Loving trails. Not that those trails were rides in the park for Texas cowboys. Various routes. One major difference between the Chisholm Trail, meaning the Texas to Kansas cattle trail, and not the Oklahoma to Kansas path, named after trader Jesse Chisholm, and its forerunner, the Texas to Missouri Shawnee Trail, was that the Western Trail did more than send cattle to packing houses. Sure, Western Trail cowhands brought cattle to railroad shipping points like Dodge City, Boot Hill Museum, and Ogallala, Boot Hill Cemetery, to feed millions of people, but it was also used to stock ranges in Wyoming, Montana, and the Dakotas. When Kansas quarantine laws, to prevent the spread of a Texas fever, often fatal to Kansas cattle, spread westward, more Chisholm Trail drovers began using the Western Trail. Most trail historians credit John T. Lytle for blazing the Western Trail, later also called the Old Fort Griffin and Fort Dodge Trail, when he drove a herd from southern Texas and to the Red Cloud Agency, then located in near western Nebraska's Fort Robinson in 1874. The trail began in Bandera County, where Hunter founded Frontier Times Museum, that's still around, in the town of Bandera in 1927. The trail basically went through Kerrville, Museum of Western Art, to near Menard, and on to Albany, Fort Griffin State Historic Site, and Vernon, Red River Valley Museum, and finally on to Doan's Trading Post, established in 1878 by Jonathan Doan and his nephew, Corwin F. Doan. Near there, the herd swam the Red River into present-day Oklahoma. With herds usually numbering around 2,000 to 2,500 cattle, the route taken depended on grass, so the routes varied. Two routes today, U.S. Highway 183 and State Highway 34 promote the Western Trail, which passed through Fort Supply before crossing into Kansas. Elsewhere, trails split or trail bosses had options. They might take the Ghost Trail, also known as the Quanah Detour, from present-day Quanah, Texas, Quanah, Acme, and Pacific Depot Museum, to the Salt Fork of the Red River near Mangum, Oklahoma, Old Greer County Museum and Hall of Fame. Or they could follow the Mobeetee Trail to Mobeetee, Mobeetee Jail Museum, in the Texas Panhandle. No matter where they went, it was rarely easy. In 1882, F.M. Polk, who had been driving cattle for a decade, hired on for a drive-in in which he had plenty of bad horses to ride, and stampedes were so numerous that he could not keep track of them. There was so much rain and the cattle were so restless, we never knew what to expect. Lots of times I never pulled off my boots for 3 days and nights. Trails End. The Kansas legislature prohibited all Texas cattle from entering the state in 1885, but Texas cattle drovers soon learned they weren't just upsetting Kansans. In 1886, the Austin Daily Statesman reported, there has been some talk of holding an indignation meeting to protest against the late action of the Panhandle Free Grass Syndicates in refusing to let South Texas cattle go up the Western Trail. So the Western Trail, having sent an estimated 6 million to 7 million cattle north, faded out like the Shawnee, Chisholm, and even the Goodnight Loving. F.M. Polk wasn't sad to see it go. Left in Mobeetee in 1882 because of a quarantine, the boss and I had a row, so Polk rode out for Dodge City and bought a one-way train ticket. On my way home, Polk recalled in the Trail Drivers of Texas, I reviewed my past life as a cowboy from every angle and came to the conclusion that about all I had gained was experience, and I could not turn that into cash, so I decided I had enough of it and made up my mind to go home, get married, and settle down to farming. A wide spot in the road, National Historic Trails Interpretive Center. Founded in 2002 in Casper, Wyoming, the National Historic Trails Interpretive Center isn't about cattle drives, but those early interstates of 19th century Western America, primarily the Mormon, Oregon, California, and Pony Express trails, and the estimated 500,000 immigrants who traveled west between 1840 and 1869, and the Pony Express riders who delivered the mail. In addition to galleries focusing on the individual trails, the nonprofit museum also shows visitors Ways of the People, The U.S. Looks West, and Epilogue, The Trail Today. And while the focus is on history, this interactive museum is high-tech. From the short introductory film, Footsteps to the West, a 2003 Spur Award finalist for Best Documentary Script by Candy Moulton and Dan Galasio, to virtual rides in a stagecoach and wagons. You can even push a Mormon handcart. Online, nhtcf.org. True West Magazine, November 2023 edition. Guns of the Young Wild West. Here's a rundown of some of the more famous guns and their modern replicas from before 1873, when the Old West was young. The year 1873 could be called the Year of the Gun, because of the introduction of such iconic firearms as the 1873 Colt 45 Single Action Army Revolver, SAA, the 1873 Winchester Rifle in .44-40 caliber, and the U.S. military's adoption of the powerful .45-70 Springfield Rifle and Carbine. However, when these game-changing firearms debuted, much of the American West's story had already been acted out, much of it with what were then considered state-of-the-art guns. The hardware available to the frontiersmen in the last two decades before 1873 ranged from percussion arms to a handful of then-latest metallic cartridge firearms. Let's look at a few guns that blazed their way across our Western territories during that colorful period and explore which replicas are available and who offers them. Yesterday's Hardware. As America entered the decade of the 1870s, cap and ball firearms were rapidly being replaced by the newer, more reliable metallic cartridge guns. Nonetheless, whether due to economics, availability, or simply a lack of trust of these newfangled cartridge guns, there were holdouts still clinging to their tried and true cap lock arms. Guns like the Hawk and Plains rifle and military muzzle loading rifles like the 1855 or 1860 Springfield and British Enfield rifle muskets, or breech loaders like the older Sharps, Smith, Maynard, and other Civil War era rifles and carbines remain popular, continuing to see much usage out west. Professional hunters, scouts, and the military who ventured into hostile lands, however, were finding that the then new cartridge conversion firearms were worth their weight in gold. They favored guns like the 5070 Allen conversion of the percussion in 1861 Springfield and the 1859 and 1863 Sharps altered to take that same round, along with some newly introduced rifles like Remington's split breech carbine or their number one sporting rifles. The famed Sharps Buffalo Gun big bore rifles were also added to their arsenals for game hunting, defense, and for warfare. In addition to these conversions of the older single shot guns, the fairly new repeaters that entered the scene during the late war, including the Spencer and the Henry, were guns one could depend on without reserve. The single and double-barreled percussion and some pinfire shotguns remained the choice of many who needed a good small game or defensive firearm. For lawmen and expressmen, too, the trusty twin-tubed scatter gun still ruled. Ironically, it was not uncommon to see a frontiersman with perhaps a metallic-cased long arm and a sidearm in percussion ignition, or vice versa. All said, the guns of the pre-1873 West were often juxtapositions of firepower. The handgun, especially the revolver, an important piece of hardware to any frontiersman, went from percussion to cartridge conversions to newly designed metal-cased ammo during this era. Popular arms were any of Colt's open-top cap-and-ball Army, Navy, Dragoon, or Pocket 5 and 6 shooters, or Colt lookalikes, including the Manhattan and Cooper revolvers. Remington's top strap revolvers, Whitney 6 guns, and Star single and double actions, along with myriad wheel guns of the day, kept the frontier lively. A small number of single-shot pistols still had a presence in the last few years before 1873, but by that time they had pretty much had their day. The various cartridge conversions of the cap-lock revolvers held great appeal, even for several years after the introduction of Colt's 73 Army, largely because of the lower prices these conversion arms sold for. In 1872, Colt produced about 7,000 open-top revolvers, just prior to the introduction of their legendary 1873 Colt SAA and SNW, produced several small-bore 5 and 6 shooters, like the 32 Rimfire, No. 2 Army, one of James Butler Wild Bill Hickok's choices. Two, civilian gunsmiths were converting many cap and ball guns in a variety of creative ways. Between the Civil War and 1873, a host of metallic cartridge firearms made their appearance. There were far too many to mention here. But, for example, and undoubtedly the most famous revolvers with completely bored through chambers in their cylinders came from Smith & Wesson, S&W, when that firm broke ground for Big Bore 6 Guns with its model No. 3 American in .44 S&W American caliber. This was quickly followed by its various .44 Russian models. Also in 1872, England's double action, easily concealed, and powerful British Bulldog was introduced and gained a fair amount of notoriety with Americans, including Lieutenant Colonel James George A. Custer. American arms like the Moore, Reed's Knuckle Duster, Prescott, and several other pocket pistols undoubtedly saw use out west. Let's not forget that the Little Derringers, too. These palm-sized pistols ranged from Henry Derringer's Philadelphia single-shot percussion pistol to the 41 rim fires, like Remington's famed metallic cartridge Double Derringer, or the one-shot Southerner from Brown and Merrimack Arms, to multi-round pocket pistols from Colt, Remington, S&W, Connecticut Arms Company, and others. From Mexico to Montana, any of these concealable handguns could be found hidden among the pockets and folds of a Westerner's clothing, regardless of gender. As we can see, there was a vast selection of shooting irons pioneers could choose from in order to be well-heeled. Nowadays, thanks to the manufacturers and importers of replica firearms, history buffs and Western gun enthusiasts can enjoy a great variety of quality reproductions of the guns of yesteryear and at affordable prices, especially when compared to purchasing an original in safe, shootable condition. These replicas are made to be fired and enjoyed at the range, during reenactments, or in the hunting fields, and they can also serve as self-defense arms if needed. While I'm not advocating the use of a historical replica arm over a modern gun, remember that just because it is a replica of an old-time gun, it can serve for protection if no modern arm is available. Defense or offense were the primary reasons many of the originals were designed for, and they have a notable history of serving their purpose. Pre-1873 guns live on. If you're looking for a muzzle-loading plains rifle like the Hawken, the favorite of frontiersmen like Kit Carson and Mariano Modena, you'd do well to contact either the Hawken Shop in St. Louis, Missouri, thehawkenshop.com, which offers do-it-yourself Hawken rifle kits along with component parts, so you can custom make a Hawken of your own just the way you want it. For a fully finished quality replica Hawken imported from Italy's Divide, Petersoli, and C, you can check with Dixie Gun Works, dixiegunworks.com, or Taylors & Company, taylorsfirearms.com, and look at their selections of Hawken rifles, Kentucky rifles, and other front-loading long arms of the early West. As a personal sidelight, this writer can say that from my own experience, hunting with a Hawken rifle is a challenge and a thrill any vintage firearm buff would enjoy. Maybe you have a hankering for one of the Civil War era single-shot percussion breech loaders, like the 1863 Sharps or a Smith Carbine. If these breech holders appeal to you, look to EMF Company Incorporated, emf-company.com, or Taylors & Company for a percussion cartridge Smith Carbine replica or an 1863 Sharps clone. Shiloh Rifle Manufacturing Company, shilohrifle.com, only offers the 1863 Sharps model in carbine or infantry rifle configuration. Remember, all replica muzzle-loading arms are made strictly for use with black powder. If you've set your sights on single-shot metallic cartridge guns of the post-1865 period, which are capable of handling factory smokeless powder ammunition, there is an arsenal full of choices. To find rifles such as the 1871 Remington Rolling Block or the 1874 Sharps, which was actually introduced by Sharps in 1871, you'd do well to look up the Cimarron Firearms, Cimarron-Firearms.com, Chiapa, ChiapaFirearms.com, Dixie Gun Works, Uberti USA, Uberti-USA.com, or EMF to see what Petersoli imports they offer. Homegrown companies like Shiloh and C. Sharp's Arms Company Incorporated, C-SharpArms.com, both produce exquisite reproductions of different 1874 models, Sporters, Creedmoors, etc. Shiloh, of course, is well known for creating the famed Quigley Sharps from Tom Selleck's Australian Western movie, Quigley Down Under, along with other superb Sharps clones. I've handled and hunted with the Petersoli import replicas, as well as the American-made Shiloh and C. Sharps rifles with much success. Lever-action gunners have several newly produced Frontier-style Winchester rifles, 1873 to 95 models manufactured by Miroko Corporation of Japan, to choose from by Winchester Repeating Arms Company, WinchesterGuns.com, and several companies also import replicas of the different Frontier repeaters, such as the 1860 and the 1865 Spencer carbine, and the 1866 Yellow Boy Winchester clone, including the 1863 Henry repeater. You'll need plenty of time to check out all the various models available from Cimarron, Dixie Gun Works, Chiappa, EMF Company, Taylors & Company, and Uberti USA. Speaking of the 1863 Henry rifle, a handsome version of that damned Yankee rifle that you load on Sunday and shoot all week is being made in the good old USA by Henry USA, henryusa.com, along with their many traditionally inspired but more modern Henry rifles like the Golden Boy 22 or their Big Boy in 4570. Scatter gunners will find a selection of double-barreled shotgun offerings in pre-1873 configuration, exposed side hammers, and in full-length or the shorter-tubed coach gun models from most of the above importers listed. There are too many variations to list here, so hit the old internet trail for a quality Old West shotgun. Percussion revolvers like the various Colt and Remington models are offered by most of the replica outfits that sell black powder revolvers. These include Cimarron Firearms, Dixie Gun Works, EMF Company, Taylors & Company, and Uberti USA. Dixie Gun Works also offers replicas of the Star single and double action percussion revolvers and the LeMat, although it's not likely many LeMat revolving hand cannons would have been seen on the frontier. Cartridge conversion revolvers have enjoyed favor in recent years. Six guns, like the handsome copies of the Colt Richards and Richards Mason-style Army and Navy models, and the Remington conversions are being packed by more and more Old West reenactors and sport shooters. Among the pre-1873 guns that were made strictly as metallic cartridge revolvers is Cimarron's Uberti-made copy of S&W's first model number 3 American revolver, introduced a couple of years ago. Historically, it was the first practical large bore, 44 American caliber, U.S.-made, manufactured in 1870-72, metallic cartridge six-shooter. Cimarron and others, including Dixie Gun Works, EMF Company, and Taylors & Company, are importing clones of the later S&W Russian model with its unique spur on the trigger guard. These companies are well worth looking into for your next piece of frontier hardware. Even though I've devoted this article strictly to the guns that were in use before 1873, I feel the game-changing and original 1873 Colt SAA should be mentioned, since it is still being manufactured and offered by Colt. Colt.com. Contact them for details on acquiring a newly manufactured but historic Colt 45 Peacemaker. Care and feeding of replicas. If you're hunting for a metallic cartridge replica firearm, there are a number of sources for commercially manufactured smokeless powder factory ammunition, including some who offer lower recoil cowboy action loads for the guns listed in this piece. Ammo ranging from small bore to the large caliber and cowboy action offerings are available from Aguila Ammunition, Atomic Ammunition, Black Hills Ammunition, Cowboy Choice, Fiocchi Hornaday, HSM, Magtech, Remington, Sellier & Bellett, and Winchester. If you shoot a lot, you may eventually find the need for replacement parts. VTI replica gun parts can supply over 10,000 different rifle and handgun components for replicas, including those from Army San Marcos, Uberti, Pieta, Pedersoli, IAB, and others. I've obtained component parts from VTI several times, and I've always been happy with the parts and the service. Keep them in mind if you need replacement parts for your replica firearms. Although many of the modern replica houses sell accurate copies of actual models of frontier firearms, nearly all of them also offer guns that are not copies of actual known factory manufactured models from that era. Rather, they are imported variations of revolvers with non-original features, such as bird's head grips, snub-nosed, or octagon-barreled models, and six-shooters with brass rather than blued steel, backstraps, and other non-historic modifications of cap lock and metallic cartridge guns, in order to appeal to various shooters. If it's a realistic historic copy you want, rather than one altered with non-factory touches, a bit of research would be in order before making a purchase. Now you know the types of guns used before the introduction of the 1873 Winchester 4440, the Colt Single Action Army 45, and the U.S. government's 4570 Springfield Trap Door. Firearms from the decades when the Old West was young represent some of the most interesting frontier shooting irons. True West Magazine, November 2023 edition. Django Unchained by James B. Mills. A decade since the highest-grossing Western was released, the film remains controversial. There are many disconcerting issues that a young historian of the American frontier must confront as the 10-year anniversary of the release of Django Unchained recently passed without acknowledgement from True West and those who stopped paying attention to pop culture when Reagan left office. The academic cliques presently holding positions of influence are seemingly obsessed with patting each other on the back for acting like Gandhi. The archivists still hoarding their sacred public domain photo collections pick the like vultures at the worm, breathing carcass of every historian who comes their way in the hopes of foraging a dime. Then there's the deeply liberal and conservative outrage expressed over the moral implications of supposedly glorifying frontier violence by not continuously raking every outlaw and lawman who shot somebody over the coals for their 19th century actions. There's creeping up the spine concern over the apparent lack of interest in the American West among younger generations. As if all of that was not enough, the slow-burning decline of the Western film genre also continues to trouble those with an insatiable passion for frontier history. There is little comfort in knowing my own generation was not responsible for this. Anyone paying attention knows the popularity of the genre began declining in the 1970s. That might explain why so many boomers continue salivating over the same old classic westerns and deceased actors, whom most people under the age of 40 couldn't care less about in the 2020s. It seems there is always time for Tombstone, as we saw for the 28th time in last month's issue of True West, but considering their lack of coverage, one would almost think the successful miniseries The English, featuring superstar Emily Blunt, and The Last Manhunt, starring Hollywood heavyweight Jason Momoa, did not hit our screens last year. I have no doubt that watching Alan Ladd and Shane for the umpteenth time will remain a higher priority for some fossils than celebrating the success of Killers in the Flower Moon, starring Leonardo DiCaprio, in the autumn of 2023. An appreciation for the classics is fine, but as the saying goes, if you don't change with the times, then you get left behind. While nostalgia remains a powerful drug for those wishing to relive their own childhoods at the expense of the present, with the benefit of hindsight, the most grievous body blow the modern Western has suffered was the release of Unforgiven. Clint Eastwood's final Western was rightly met with critical acclaim, taking home Oscars for Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Film Editing at the 1992 Academy Awards. Gene Hackman was also highly deserving of his Best Supporting Actor triumph. Unforgiven remains a gritty and surreal portrayal of frontier life, but the film's legacy has ultimately been a procession of modern Westerns in which hardened gunmen and soldiers spend half their time wallowing in teary-eyed repentance over the things they have done. This was demonstrated by Kurt Russell's initially guilt-ridden Wyatt Earp in Tombstone, Kevin Costner's cow-punching gunman in Open Range, and Christian Bale's reflective cavalry officer in Hostiles. Recently, Hollywood even had Dane DeHaan's Billy Bonney blubbering into a bottle of whiskey in The Kid. In portraying gunfights as deeply immoral, Unforgiven subsequently transformed the Western into a frontier version of The Breakfast Club. It is difficult to envision Wyatt Earp ever crying on somebody's shoulder over the cowboys he shot down in his younger years. Geronimo went to his grave wishing he had killed more Mexicans, and the surviving participants of the Lincoln County War never sounded particularly rueful over their actions. Although Jim Jarmusch's Dead Man, 1995, featuring megastar Johnny Depp and the Coen brothers' successful remake of True Grit, 2010, provided some welcome relief from frontier sorrow, it was Quentin Tarantino who delivered the highest-grossing Western of all time in unremorseful fashion. Django Unchained began raiding movie theaters like a horde of pissed-off Comanches and took no prisoners on December 25th, 2012. The film made more money in 1 week than Tombstone made throughout its entire theatrical run and eventually grossed $449 million at the box office. The glittering performances of Jamie Foxx, Leonardo DiCaprio, Samuel L. Jackson, and Kerry Washington were met with widespread acclaim. The film also snared Academy Awards for Quentin Tarantino, Best Original Screenplay, and Christoph Waltz, Best Supporting Actor. Astonishingly, real-life cowboy Jamie Foxx never appeared on a True West cover, despite having played the lead role in the most financially successful Western ever made. Without spoiling the entire plot for any readers who may have missed the film, Django Unchained tells the story of a slave in the pre-Civil War South named Django, Jamie Foxx, who gains his freedom after encountering German dentist-turned-bounty hunter Dr. Keen Schultz, Christoph Waltz. A fortuitous turn of events brought Django and myself together, the amiable Schultz later explains. Django and Dr. Schultz soon develop an affinity and eventually partner up as bounty hunters, which proves a fruitful arrangement for both. "I kill people and sell their corpses for cash," Schultz nonchalantly tells his new partner. Django's self-assurance steadily grows as he displays an instinctive talent with a six-shooter and a rifle. "The kid's a natural," his suitably impressed German mentor remarks. Throughout their travels, Dr. King Schultz learns that Django, the D is silent, hillbilly, is a married man. The former slave was cruelly separated from his wife, Brunhilde von Schaft, Kerry Washington, when the two were sold at a slave auction following an unsuccessful escape attempt from a plantation. Dr. Schultz and Django, now the fastest gun in the South, set out on a quest to find the black bounty hunter's estranged spouse. Their search soon leads them into orbit of the film's primary antagonist, a suave but repulsive slaver named Calvin Candy, Leonardo DiCaprio, who runs an infamous plantation known as Candyland in Mississippi. "Ain't no slave ain't heard of Candyland," Django tells his German companion. Quentin Tarantino has long been a master of creating an atmosphere of steadily increasing suspense. The director does not disappoint in the lead-up to the film's explosive culmination, which sees Django standing tall in some dapper burgundy threads, a cigarette holder resting between his lips, and his own brand of Southern justice dished out with an appropriate vengeance. Who says it can't be fun when the rabbit has the gun? The versatile Jamie Foxx was ever bit the iron-nerved protagonist that Django Unchained needed in its leading role, with the delightful, talented Kerry Washington proving the perfect choice to play his resilient lady love. Samuel L. Jackson shocked some of his longtime fans by playing Calvin Candy's elderly headhouse slave, Stephen, the kind of character contemptuously referred to as an Uncle Tom in our present time. "I told Quentin when he called me and I read the script, 'So you want me to be the most hated Negro in cinematic history?'" Jackson later recalled. His performance was a tour de force. While the role of Dr. King Schultz appears to have fit Christoph Waltz like a custom-made suit, Leonardo DiCaprio initially struggled with his portrayal of the detestable Calvin Candy. This was one of the most narcissistic, self-indulgent, racist, most despicable characters I've ever read in my entire life, the actor later said. After Samuel L. Jackson put his arm around Leonardo and employed him to get over it, as it was just another Tuesday for us, DiCaprio ended up so deeply in character that he carried on acting after accidentally cutting his hand on some glass while filming a scene at a dinner table, earning himself a standing ovation from the cast and crew. The film was further complemented with strong performances from Walton Goggins, James Remar, Jonah Hill, Don Johnson, James Russo, Bruce Dern, M.C. Gainey, and Ato Ezendo in various supporting roles scattered throughout the story. Franco Nero, star of the 1966 Italian film Django, also showed up in a welcome cameo role, although the less said about Quentin Tarantino's atrocious attempt at an Australian accent in his own cameo appearance, the better. Like many Tarantino films, Django Unchained walked hand in hand with controversy. The movie was roasted by some for its frequent use of racial slurs. It wasn't stamped with wholesale approval from the black community either, as demonstrated by Spike Lee's criticism over the film's portrayal of slavery. The film was also viewed with derision by a handful of twitchy, self-pitying white folks who consider themselves the oppressed victims of modern society. While some younger people are put off by the interviews in which John Wayne sounded like a card-carrying member of the Ku Klux Klan, the complaints over the racism portrayed in Django Unchained, the story of a freed slave set primarily on plantations in the 1850s Deep South, were like complaining about there was too much anti-Semitism in a Holocaust film. History is not always considerate of our modern-day sensitivities. The grievances expressed over the grossly exuberant reward sums offered for the outlaws whom Django and Dr. King Schultz pursue in the film were admittedly valid, and there is no hard evidence that Mandingo fighting occurred in the antebellum South. Django Unchained also perpetuates the myth of the lone bounty hunter in frontier times. There was no Dog the Bounty Hunter in the Wild West, historian Art T. Burton recently said. The indignant response to the occasional use of rap music was to be expected in some circles, although many a child of the 80s and 90s was probably exhilarated by the pulsating sound of the late Tupac Shakur, the Elvis of hip-hop for any unfamiliar old-timers. Spitting some lyrics while Django's revolvers are spitting bullets in Candyland. There were also criticisms of the violence depicted in Django Unchained, which was reminiscent of the spaghetti westerns to which the film pays considerable homage. It should be noted that the good actually kills more men than the bad and the ugly, combined in Sergio Leone's 1966 western classic. Like the man with no name, both Dr. King Schultz and Django are unapologetic for their violent actions on the harsh frontier. They shed no tears for the many men in their rifles and revolvers used send tumbling into an early grave, and the film steadily pushes toward its climax in an unrepentant blitz of blood-spattering gunfire, or hell if it were run by Charlton Heston. Wherever the modern Western is heading, Benicio del Toro needs to saddle up and play the badass vaquero role for which he is clearly suited. Django Unchained proved we can still make time for the blockbuster Western, despite the anxious wait for that highly anticipated text message. That insatiable need to be swallowed up and bathe in the warm drool of the latest deeply satisfying social media comments. The swelling generations are busy downloading apps, while the wings of knowledge are sharply plucked by the overripe hand of their own personal reality show. Yes, those young people staring at their iPhones can also enjoy a Western. They just prefer to watch celebrated actors from their own time, rather than Gary Cooper and Fess Parker. Django Unchained showed us that there was still hope for the Western genre and all its uncompromising glory following its release in 2012. No other Western has come close to replicating the film's immense popularity and cultural impact in the decades since. Even if the hugely successful tale of a freed slave turned gunman proves to be the death rattle of the Western box office hit, I like the way you die, boy.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.